Colonel Chris Budahas is the host of First Coast Military Life. Now I almost said First Colonel Military Life.
Oh, my
gosh.
I've got
Colonel in my brain.
Oh, my God.
But I've learned that I am not the only one who makes the Lieutenant Colonel mistake.
I know.
Lieutenant Colonel just seems to roll off the tongue.
I know, and it sounds like it's really expensive, right?
It does. It sounds bigger than Colonel.
It does.
But it's not.
Because you're like Lieutenant General. It's right. Over Major General. Go figure.
But you are a full bird Colonel.
I was. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. So weigh in a little bit here. What... And I probably should have asked you to jump in with my questions with Eben, but what are we missing here? So 8 p.m. Eastern Time deadline tonight, and we've got 4 minutes before we need to take a break, and then we'll come back.
Okay.
And keep you past the break if you're able to do
I'm
that.
I'm able to, yeah.
Okay. So Iran has rejected the 45-day ceasefire proposal.
Right.
We have an 8 p.m. Eastern Time deadline tonight. Strategy-wise, what are we looking at? Because it doesn't look like they're going to capitulate.
Well, I don't think they're going to capitulate. I don't think there's no reason, right? You know, say like the Ukraine-Russia negotiations. Why would the Russians negotiate when they're actually winning? I'm not saying the Iranians are winning, but they are not, you know, bending a knee right now to what the administration's trying to do. And it just shows you the resiliency. Like I mentioned yesterday, geographically, Iran's gigantic. It's from the Mississippi River all the way to the East Coast. So trying to strike all these targets, take out a regime that's been in power for well over almost 50 years is quite a bit of an undertaking to do. And then if you take a historical perspective, looking backwards in time, you know, only in a few times have we actually destroyed the enemy to the point that they capitulated. You know, what I'm talking about there is, you know, think circa World War II with Germany and Japan. We literally destroyed them by bombing them and then invading them. But there was always an invasion element to that. I don't necessarily condone that. But I do know is war colleges will be studying this for centuries. And there was this Italian aviation theorist that stated between World War I and World War II, Duchesne, said that you can bomb your way to victory. And as we found out in World War II, that is not a true statement. And that goes back to the enemy's got the will to fight. There's a lot of questions right now. Are we escalating or de-escalating? I think we're escalating to bring this to a ceasefire. But, you know, what does the end game look like? You know, what does defeat in the mind of the Iranian leadership look like? We have to be thinking about how do they see this? They own the clocks. We might have to stopwatch right now, as we said before. You know, Americans.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
A quick question about Eben's point that, you know, their leadership, he said, or what is left of it. They have seemed pretty resilient in, you know, just regrouping and, you know, reassigning new leaders kind of as we've taken them out.
Everybody does that, right? I mean, there's always a succession of command within the military. I think last year's military operations against the regime probably doubled that down, that they had to have this capability. You know, I'm not saying they're Soviet-esque per se in their doctrine, but there's definitely a central command authority associated with that. But some other folks that are speculating right now that are, you know, military experts, that after last year's bombing campaign, they basically delegated certain authorities down to those lower regional divisional commanders in order to take initiative if they were decapitated. So pretty smart move on their behalf.
And the decapitation strategy is not one. I know that we've talked before about this, but the decapitation strategy is not one that has been successful for the United States in the past. And for those who don't know, what is the decapitation strategy?
Well, decapitation theory, I mean, there's actually a theory to this, is the fact that you take out the leader, the regime will fall. Historically, as you take a look at it, that is not a true statement. It has rarely ever worked, only in a few times in since biblical history has it ever worked as a doctrine, but also as a strategy.
Are people here responding to that militarily, saying, you know, what are you hearing kind of behind the scenes to the extent that you can talk about it?
Because
what I'm hearing behind the scenes is people going, I cannot believe we're trying this again because it has never worked. Is there something different that would indicate that this might work this time?
No, there's no indication of that. I mean, a lot of people are speculating. It leads to some pretty funny memes, but here's the reality. It's putting people in danger both on their side and our side. And here's the reality: as I filled up my truck this morning, there's issues, and the American people are extremely resilient. They will sacrifice, you know, financially in order to support something they believe in. But right now, the public polls are very low. And this goes back to, in my opinion, proper communication by our leadership, both the political and the military leadership. Ultimately, it's up to the political leadership because they're ultimately in charge in accordance with our Constitution. So we have to have clear communication, a clear understanding of the American public. And, you know, let's be honest, our American public is sometimes not informed. This should be a call to action that we need to pay attention to what's happening, you know, because this has global ramifications. Let's be honest, if you don't like the price of gas now, it can go up, by the way.
And by the way, just to that, locally, I know we reported some of the gas stations that had low prices yesterday. Beach Boulevard, I think there was a Murphy's gas station that had gas at $4.09 a gallon, which I travel.
That's cheap.
Yeah, that was very cheap for yesterday. So just for our listeners to know that. And we do want to continue our in-depth conversation with Colonel Chris Budahas, the host of First Coast Military Life. We'll do so when we come back at the top of the hour. However, before I forget, what's going on your show this weekend?
Okay, this weekend we've got from military service to public service. I got Angela Gaff with Jacksonville Sheriff's Office and then Chief Ronaldo with the Jacksonville Fire and Rescue Department coming in to talk about, you know, service in the fire rescue space and in the sheriff's deputy space. And it's not just, you know, firefighters, and it's not also just policemen. It's also the folks that support them, people in the IT, the HR, and such. So we jump into basically, what are the opportunities if you want to continue to serve our community that you can have with JSO and JFRD?
Very interesting. And that's so important for so many who serve their country. They want to continue that legacy of service when they get out.
Yeah, absolutely.
And breaking news, we do have an indication that the U.S. has hit Karg Island, critical to Iran's oil industry, ahead of the Trump administration imposed deadline. That's according to a source with the Associated Press. The U.S. has hit Karg Island, according to a source with the Associated Press. We'll have more on that. The news just keeps on coming, Chris Budahas.
All right, Christine Bellino, it sure does, doesn't it?
So ahead of the deadline, we have hit Karg Island, allegedly, and we'll keep continuing to follow that breaking news and confirm that momentarily. I hesitate to ask you this because even though you are a retired member of the armed services, you could they could still go after you, right? As Mark Kelly has found out. But
I'm not scared.
You've just invited a whole bunch of stuff, but is what is happening now in the military indicative of a purge? We're seeing almost two dozen, more than a dozen, and depending upon what stage of the leaving they're at, almost two dozen top brass being relieved or told that they need to step down. Is this a purge?
That's a touchy subject.
I
don't know, to be honest with you. So, again, bring a little history back. When you take a look at the Obama administration, those 8 years, the Biden administration, even, you know, going back to the Bush years, there was a series of officers relieved. As I mentioned yesterday, typically with a relief, there's a cause, right? You're relieved for a cause. You know, there's a reason why they're removing you from your position. So could there be? I don't know. But I think we got to keep an eye on it. I think there should definitely be a conversation, at least from the Secretary of War, saying, you know, these officers removed, you know, thanking them for their service. That's kind of a standard thing there. But the nature of which this is occurring, it's a big question mark, right? Especially when you put on the backdrop of what's occurring in the Middle East and Venezuela. If you remember Venezuela, that happened a couple of months ago. So hopefully we're not seeing a reduction of good officers. And I don't know General George. I do know General Hodney, both phenomenal officers with great reputation. So their removal, you know.
Explain for our listeners what they did.
What do you mean what they did?
Their positions.
Their positions. Okay. Well, Chief Staff of the Army. So the Senior General of the Army, General Randy George, again, wounded in combat, served through all ranks, got a great reputation.
Impeccable record.
I've never heard anybody say anything bad about him, which is... And I guarantee Chris Budahas has been talked about bad a number of times. And then, you know, Dave Hodney, he was the Training and Transformation Command commanding general. And he just took over recently, about 5 months ago or so. Again, spent a lot of time in Ranger Regiment, especially during the Global War on Terrorism. Again, wounded in combat and very decorated. So their removal was kind of a question mark within the Army. There's definitely a reverberation of, like, what's going on. But let's be honest, at the end of the day, you know, the president and the secretary of war get to pick the people that they want to work for them. Again, as an officer, you serve at the pleasure of the president of the United States, especially at the general officer rank. So that's just kind of the business. But, you know, it goes back to, and I've talked about this a couple months ago, the Civ-Mil trust factor is very delicate. I call it the three converging circles on one another. It gives you that Venn diagram. You know, the people, the government, and the military population is very delicate. And if we break that trust between the people, the government, and the military, it could be a problem. You know, we live in a great patriotic society, or our community down here in Northeast Florida, Southeast Georgia. But could you imagine people? My dad was a Vietnam veteran. I mean, literally, when he came home from Vietnam, he took his uniform off, and he did a full, you know, 30-year career in the Navy. I mean, that's a shame, and I would hate to see that trust being broken. But I do see some polls saying that the trust in the military is getting a little bit shaken by the American public.
The American public's trust in the military.
Yeah.
In the military as an institution, certainly not in the military leadership that we...
No. And I think some of that's, you know, if you spend too much time on Instagram and X, you probably get the wrong impression. So, again, I think it's a delicate trust. We got to continue to watch that. Not necessarily here in Northeast Florida, Southeast Georgia, do you see a shaking of that trust. But, you know, nationwide, people are questioning what's going on. And if we're not communicating, I think communication, just like a marriage, is extremely important as we continue to, you know, conduct operations around the world. So, by the way, as I reminded somebody the other day, you know, we're on the first half of this Trump presidency. So we have to make sure we got a good line of communication between our national leadership and our population who voted them in.
From a military staffing standpoint, it's safe to assume that most of these folks in, you know, who we consider quote unquote top brass have careers that have been longer than 20 years. But some of the folks who have been let go don't, and they really give up most of their benefits and things because you really don't get many military benefits unless you've served for 20 years.
Yeah.
So if somebody is in 18 and they decide to let them go, that's it.
Yeah, it's true. Now, these officers have almost, in the general officer case, well over 30 years. But again, let's be honest, you know, I could have made a lot more money, you know, in the corporate world, you know, in the reality of it. I sacrificed because, one, I wanted to serve, and two, I enjoyed the people I worked with, and I thought it was an honorable profession to be in. If folks do not feel that way while they're in service, that is dangerous. And I've heard people talk about the draft. There was an article this morning talking about the individual readiness reserves, a.k.a. people that had gotten out that are not drilling reservists but can be recalled as a mobilization population, which is a true statement, but it should not be the go-to if you need people as they dip into our IRR program.
Well, and also right now there's so much talk about the SAVE Act and voter ID and, you know, making certain that people are verified to vote and things like that. But if you are registered for the draft, you don't need any ID other than your driver's license.
That's it.
That's it.
Yeah.
Or a Social Security card.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of animosity being created about that subject. Again, our breaking news, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Chris Budahas, retired Colonel Chris Budahas, who hosts First Coast Military Life and is our military analyst. Breaking news this morning, the U.S. military has struck targets on Iran's Karg Island, where Iran exports 90% of its oil. U.S. officials said none of the strikes involved oil assets, which is what we're hearing right now, but U.S. oil prices rose 3% on trading futures after the strikes to nearly $116 a barrel. So the information that you had about filling up your truck this morning, probably good thing that
good
you
timing.
Did it this morning instead of this afternoon. We had spoken with Fox's Evan Brown a little bit about the targeting of specific
civilian infrastructure.
Yeah, civilian infrastructure. The U.S. military saying that these are military targets. Certainly that was not the case with the school where 60 children, young girls, were killed.
Yeah.
However, the investigation is still happening on that, but all indications seem to be that the video on board the missiles showed that it was indeed a school, and the U.S. is suffering a lot of international backlash because of that. But how do we ascertain whether these targets are indeed military targets versus civilian targets? And are you confident that what we're targeting is military?
I hope so. I mean, here's what I know, you know, and without getting classification, we have great intelligence capability. However, I'll go back to my comment earlier about how big Iran is. You know, Mississippi River to the East Coast, from Maine down to Florida, it's gigantic. So as you discriminate each target, you can take a look at each of them. But the reality of it is that things change, right? It might have been a former, that school specifically, and I don't know this as a fact, it might have been a former, you know, military piece of infrastructure turned into a school years ago, and we just kind of missed the bubble. Again, goes back to Americans like our wars, fast, cheap, and bloodless. The reality of it is blood on both sides, and that's very unfortunate. So that'll get washed out. You know, we got a lot of great successes. You look at what happened in Venezuela. You look at the rescue of the air downmen, the downed airmen most recently. Only the U.S. can do that to the level of professionalism. But that's a high bar to kind of sustain. So, and a lot of risk associated with it. And I know there was a lot of conversation this morning about, you know, CIA, and some of the things I wish we wouldn't talk about on the air. But the reality of it is, the American government, our intelligence agencies, and our military can do some pretty phenomenal things. But you know, if we get used to that high bar of it being bloodless and lack of destruction, that's a question mark. Going back to your comment about being, you know, civilian infrastructure being used for military purposes, if it's being used, then absolutely can be targeted in accordance with the land of law warfare. However, I'm always beckoning back to history is second and tenth order effects of these strikes. So if this is something we're going to need, the population needs, then is it going to work or not? And then you take a look at our in-state. These methods of which we use, these means, these ends, ways, and means to get to the end of what we're trying to do, our ways and means, if one of our means is to destroy the civilian infrastructure, what does this mean in the long term? Will the civilians turn towards us or against us? Typically, history shows that they turn against us unless we, you know, purely destroy them. And then the second thing is who ends up rebuilding it? Well, it's going to be the international community, including the U.S. as part of that. So if we're going to do it, let's make sure we're doing it for all the right reasons. And we think about the second and third order effects of this. If it's like, hey, it's urgent, it needs to be done in order to save American lives in the process, then so be it. One thing before I get back to you that I'm keeping my eye on is coalition building. Are we going to be able to build a coalition? This is going to take more than us and Israel to bring this to a standstill, and I'm kind of keeping an eye on that.
So one of the things that we had said would happen, and we being the United States, certainly not the people in this room, but we as the United States had said, was that the citizens of Iran would rise up and support us against their government. We have not seen that.
No, we haven't.
And we've seen quite the opposite. And we did bring to the attention of many, you know, that Iran is not just the government, but the citizens of Iran are posting videos on social media. And I understand that, you know, we don't see everything.
Yeah, that could be one angle, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But what we're seeing is very pro-Iran, very anti-U.S., and specifically the sentiment that this is a distraction from the Epstein files seems to be the main core thing that's coming out of Iran.
Okay.
And again, I'll go to that analogy with the names on the bombs. U.S. soldiers do not, and I say soldiers collectively, to include airmen, seamen, everyone.
And guardians,
yes. do not have names to put on those missiles. So for us, this is not a war where we feel like, where we, meaning, you know, members of the military would say they feel like there is an injustice to right. So that's number one. So one could say that that's very demeaning, and it doesn't make you have that fight in your heart to continue the fight. And then we saw what we saw in Polyglot, which was that, you know, members of the American public were betting on when the pilot would be found, or the weapons warfare officer would be found.
Yeah.
And then Polyglot, which...
Polymarket.
I'm sorry, Polymarket.
Yeah, Polyglot, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Polymarket, in which Donald Trump Jr. is an investor, then issued an apology to say, you know, that this wasn't right. But long after, you know, the media picked that up. So what are we missing here? What is the thing that we're not getting? This is why we're in Iran.
Well, I think America needs to, you know, turn on Fox News, turn on CNN, do some reading, take a look at everything. You got to look at all the information. You got to make decisions based on your own, you know, your own opinion of what you see. Don't listen to one or the other. This whole thing, I mean, let's be honest, when you talk about the Iranian people, they've been filled with propaganda for a long time.
Right.
That includes the American population. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you don't think you're being propagandized against, if I can use that as a verb, take a look at your social media feed. You know, you'll be like, oh, wow, why am I constantly getting these feeds? So for the Iranian population, they've been told that we're the devil for decades. So to think the population is going to turn very quickly is an unknown. And even, you know, this is a hypothetical, you know, with all our issues, is number one, I've traveled to 52 different countries, fought there, whatever, trained. That sounds like a lot to some people, not many to others, which is fine. But the reality of it, this is the best nation in the world, but we still have misinformation that is going to influence how we make decisions. And so I got to tell people, don't watch, you know, one news station, don't read one, you know, website and such. You got to make your own decisions. So to think the Iranian people are going to quickly turn, you know, against their population is hard to believe, because let's be honest, they're a proud Persian people. They've been Persian. I remind people, they're not Arabs. They're Persians. And you know, when your homeland's attacked, regardless of what you think of your government, sometimes you'll pick up arms to go fight the invaders, so to speak. And we've been known as invaders in the Middle East for a long time.
Right, long history of the Persian Empire. What are we not asking? Well, before I ask that question, I'll ask you one more. Should the average person right now who's going, why are they spending so much time talking about the conflict in Iran? Why is Christine spending all this time talking to Chris Budahas about what's happening in Iran? It doesn't affect my day-to-day life.
Because history shows a slippery slope that you can quickly move into a bigger, larger conflict that you didn't expect to happen. I would encourage folks, if you like history or you just want to be an informed populace, I rewatched for the third time Turning Point Vietnam. It's basically a five-part series on Netflix. And a lot of folks know, and in the Johnson administration, those who actually paid attention in high school and college, that the Johnson administration, there was a series of lies. And then obviously, you know, Richard Nixon came in later, and then we had Watergate and such. But they dial it back to World War II, post-World War II, and then you get into this Eisenhower, Kennedy era, and you start to see the slippery slope, which looks very small, like, hey, just, you know, you're kind of losing your footing a little bit, which turns into this major war that results in 58,000 Americans killed in action, which has repercussions. Oh, by the way, the Vietnam War, doctrinally, organizationally, has repercussions on how the military operates today. You know, so
wasn't going to bring it up, but you did. So yeah. Is this our Vietnam?
I hope not. I don't know. I hope not. If I was predicting, I would say no. But then again, I don't know what's going to happen here in the future. And then again, the end state. If the end state was destruction of the Air Force, destruction of the Navy, destruction of ballistic missiles, was that really a true end? Or if that is the end, have we met it? And then we just got to, you know, pack up and leave now. So.
And what am I not asking that you think that should be asked? Not just me, just all media.
We got to have a conversation with the international community. What does this mean? Because it's got global repercussions. You know, China and Russia are watching from the sidelines. You know, we talked about this thing in the military that China and Russia are pacing threats, quickly followed by Iran and North Korea, then terrorism on the backside of that. So if this is the third pacing threat in that order, what is Russia and China? What are they doing? What are they seeing? You know, how are they helping the Iranians? How are they not helping? There was question marks of the Russians helping with intelligence for strike operations for Iranian ballistic missiles to hit across the Middle East, include U.S. assets, you know, naval and fixed assets across the Middle East. So, you know, what does that mean? And then, you know, again, a slippery slope. What are we going to do about it? So.
Always very insightful to talk with you and the international community weighing in on what's happening with Pete Hegseth and some of his language. And you and I had talked during the break about the fact that the president said he's not worried about threats of being considered a war criminal, regardless of who is in office when the president leaves office. It doesn't matter what the U.S. says. The Hague can still come after them.
Absolutely. And I'll leave this. I know we're going to wrap up here. So I've heard some friends say, we just can go it alone, right? Well, like, we're with the Israelis on this. You know, and there's also a question mark. If we do a ceasefire, are the Israelis going to abide by it or not? That's one question mark. The second is, historically, America has really not gone alone. If you think about even the Revolutionary War, the French were helping support us. So that to go it alone is not a great way to do this, what we're doing. And the world is so interconnected these days globally that it's got gigantic repercussions. And if it starts to strike home, you know, have impacts on parts of Asia, South America, Latin America, and others, you can have other hotspots pop up. You know, I say hotspots, like military hotspots pop up around the world as a result of destabilization of those countries alone as a result of, what we're doing in the Middle East. That's just a reality.
Chris Budahas, First Coast Military Life, thank you for your service and for your educating us here today.
Same to you.
The U.S. military reportedly hitting targets on Iran's Karg Island this morning, where Iran exports 90% of its oil. An official says none of the strikes involved oil assets. U.S. oil prices rising at least 3% right now after the strikes to nearly $116 a barrel. This is in advance of the president's 8 p.m. Tuesday night deadline.